You want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
I'm not even gonna shoot.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much that.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor, it's gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC Vegas 17, Thompson versus Neal. I will do all of this with one half, the exact equal half to the other half of fight. I'm getting in trouble, Matt. If I continue to play favorites, I'm getting in trouble on the other show. But I'm speaking, of course, to the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
Doing great, John. How are you doing this weekend?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited. Anytime I get to talk fights with you, I'm excited. So we're good. Matt, we talked about this last time out. I never want to take away from what we got by talking about what we lost. But let's talk about some of the moving pieces of last night's card as well. And then I want to talk about how you felt about the card on paper. So what we lost was Bilal Muhammad and Sean Brady. We lost Leon Edwards and Khamzat Chimaev. We lost Rick Glenn and Carlton Minus. We lost Tyson Nam fighting. We lost Alexander Pantoja fighting. We lost Misha Cirkunov and Ryan Spann fighting. This is what I'm seeing. It jumps out to me. So in the end, did we get a card that got you excited, or were you a little bit upset about some of the stuff we lost?
So I was a little happy that the Khamzat Chimaev Leon Edwards fight, it at least got canceled far enough out that we were still given a 5-round main event. And I don't know what it is, but I hate it when they do those 3-round main events, Bellator style. Like when they ended up doing Anthony Smith, Alexander Rakic, like you're a world-class athlete. Just make it the 5 rounds for the main event. Make it feel more like it is kind of a big spectacle. And I was pretty happy with the main event that we ended up getting with Wonderboy and Jeff Neal. It wasn't the most competitive fight ever, and it wasn't, you know, maybe the most exciting fight ever, but it was a really, really fun high-level striking matchup between, you know, one of those classic gatekeeper scenarios, if you will, with Wonderboy being that gatekeeper to the elite. The fight that I was the most upset about missing out on was that Alejandro Pantoja-Manel Cape fight, because Manel Cape, everyone knows, he knocked out Kai Ascura over in ONE Championship, one of the top flyweight bantamweights in the world, and his fight against Pantoja would have been absolutely phenomenal. And this is how good the UFC thinks Manel Cape is. They were willing to have him step in if Brandon Moreno or Deiveson Figueiredo were not able to make the title fight last weekend. So that's how high the UFC is on that guy, and it's how high I am on him too. But honestly, all things considered, I think we got a decent card, a lot of decisions. If you were looking for finishes, it was not the card last night, but I was still pretty happy with what we got all together.
All right, Matt, let's begin with the main event. Stephen Wonderboy Thompson has fought at the highest levels of this game, twice fighting Tyron Woodley, neither time capturing the belt. Now, despite his recent success, his age dictates that he keeps gates. So tonight it was Contender Series alum, or last night, Jeff Neal, who was at the gate, and he did not get to enter the decision. Red 50-45s all over the board. Matt, what'd you see in this one?
So it was a really interesting fight. And I got to be honest, Craig and I don't really revert on our predictions all that often. Normally, once we do the prediction show, we do the question mark kicks, the live show before the show. Our predictions stay the same. And all week long, I was thinking, okay, Jeff Neal's going to go in there. It's a small cage. It just feels like Wonderboy at 37. And I feel uncomfortable calling him Wonderboy. I got to be honest, I'm 22 and I feel pretty old. So the fact that he's 15 years older than me, running around with the nickname Wonderboy, it's a little odd, but that's besides the point. As the week progressed, I kept on looking back at that Vicente Luque fight. And everyone knows I love Vicente Luque. Like, I'm his number one fan. I probably always will be. He got pieced up by Wonderboy, and he fights in a very similar style to a Jeff Neal. I think Luque probably hits a little bit harder than Neal does. It's just Neal keeps things a little bit tighter, and he's a little bit better defensively. So on Saturday, right before the card, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go with Wonderboy. And I'm really glad that I did, because it feels like with Wonderboy, if you have success, you're going to be able to keep on finding success doing what you're doing. His style doesn't really change that much. It's just, okay, can you figure it out or can you not figure it out? And for Jeff Neal, things just kept on getting worse for him. I did like in the fifth round, he just kind of said, screw it, and started throwing flurries. And he was able to connect a little bit with Wonderboy. But like Wonderboy on two good legs, striking out in the middle, like I don't know a single welterweight who can beat him in a pure striking matchup. Like, and it is weird too, people call Wonderboy a gatekeeper. I've been, you know, guilty of that myself, but he's the number 5 ranked welterweight in the world and one of the best weight classes. So I think, and again, I'm to blame, I think I've underrated Wonderboy and where he is at this stage in his career.
You know, this fight was interesting for me because I saw a lot of things earlier that I liked from Jeff Neal, and mostly of all, and if you're a boxing fan and you listen to this podcast, I guess the first question would be why. But the second question would be, the statement would be, please go easy on me when I make the statement I'm about to make, which is I saw the Mike Tyson peekaboo style in Jeff Neal, and I liked it. Early on, he was smart enough to keep his hands high, to keep the kicks kind of from taking his head off. But what he did that I liked was he kept his hands high. He used that. He kept them high while he was pressuring. And then when he got close enough, he just threw from that high guard to find some strikes. I happen to think early on that was a better plan than it turned out to be, right? So Wonder Boy did a lot of good things. He, you know, always keeps his hands low, but that's how he fights, and it works for him. He also doesn't keep his head back as far as Machida does, but he protects his head well. I thought that he was moving his head well. I do think he fell into a little bit of a pattern in the way that he was circling out. It seemed like he was circling out left more than right, and I kept expecting Neal to throw like a Rampage Jackson-type hook, the one that took out Chuck Liddell, as he was sort of like, you know, escaping out, because that's the hope when you're a young fighter. You say, okay, I'm not quite so – and if this is a Robin Black thing, I apologize to everybody, but I heard this somewhere before. And it's called the flow. The flow is basically when you're, you know, you're operating at such a high level that everything's sort of clicking, the mental, the physical, all that. And what typically happens is in a fight like this, one fighter has regressed physically and the other fighter has not yet progressed mentally. So it makes it a pretty good fight, right? So Jeff Neal's not where, where Wonder Boy is mentally, but he's quick enough to like maybe catch him, right? You know, Wonder Boy thinks he can get out, makes the right read, but just doesn't do it quite as quick as he should. So I thought that's what we're going to see, but kudos to Wonder Boy. I think the thing that most I took from this fight where I really will tip the old Fight Night Picks cap to Wonder Boy is he was hurt in the fifth. It was obvious it was hurt in the fifth. I don't know if it was obvious to Jeff Neal, but obviously we knew it because of the commentators and the fact that we could see his knee. And he still went in there and slugged it out. He did not get on his bike. Now, maybe it was because his knee was hurt. He didn't get on the bike. But he just stood in there and traded when he very much did not have to stand in there and trade. He put himself in harm's way when he didn't have to and really was in not a spot to. So kudos to him for that. It shows that he's a true fighter. It shows that he has that fighting spirit. I'm not trying to cut a Modelo commercial here, but I was impressed by it. So let's get to the questions that I got leaving this fight. And the big one for me, and real quick, we'll take care of some housekeeping. Wonder Boy was up over 100 significant strikes. I think he ended up at 140. He was around 170 total strikes. So here's the question. We look at Jeff Neal, and we'll start with Jeff Neal. Is Wonder Boy such a unique fighter that really Neal takes nothing from this fight? Meaning he had this puzzle that he couldn't solve, but he's never going to see the puzzle again. So what does a guy like Jeff Neal take from a fight like this, in your opinion?
Honestly, like confidence, just making it to the end of the fifth round. And again, we're probably not going to talk about the Canelo Alvarez Callum Smith fight last night, but that's what they kept on talking about. From the eighth round on, it was just Canelo walking him down and blasting him in the head. And the announcer just constantly like, okay, his corner could throw in the towel. They could throw in the towel, but it's the whole, oh, well, it's that like, you know, it's a little patch of honor that you get from making it the distance and not getting finished. Jeff Neal got rocked in that fight. Jeff Neal got hurt in that fight on multiple occasions. And again, he didn't do great against Wonder Boy, but no one really does. I thought Jeff Neal's striking still looked good. He carries his power to the fifth round because when he was landing those shots near the end of that fight, and when Wonder Boy was a little less mobile as the fight was going on, he was landing some bombs. And Wonder Boy just has a good chin and he was able to eat them and return with his own. But I do think Jeff Neal can take a few, be it maybe it's not fight techniques that he can bring on to the next fight, but I just think the confidence of going five rounds, knowing that your cardio is good for five rounds and knowing that your power can stay until that fifth round. I know he didn't get a knockdown or anything like Darren Till did against Wonder Boy in the fifth, but I do think that there are a few positives for Jeff Neal moving forward. And it's really weird right now at 170 because you've either got strikers or you've got wrestlers. There's no real in between. And you have one or the other, and they don't really gel. You have the Jeff Neals, the Wonder Boys, the Vicente Luques in the division. And then you've also got the Colby Covingtons, the Kamaru Usmans, the Gilbert Burns of the division who are really grappling heavy. So for Jeff Neal, I think it's a learning experience. I do think being in there, and this is such a Joe Roganism, he might've got the rub from Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. Like, this is the first elite fighter he has ever fought. And the fact that he was able to go 25 hard minutes with him, I do think it'll be a huge confidence boost in the future.
I agree. I will say one thing technique wise, it's kind of like training at elevation, right? If you train at elevation, it's much easier to then perform not at elevation. I think if you spend 25 minutes chasing Wonder Boy around, you got to think the next guy you're chasing around ain't going to be as fast or as elusive as Wonderboy is. So it might be one of those things where there's a reason why people, run, do training with weighted vests. And there's a reason why, you know, all these things.
Dillashaw did EPO.
Exactly. That's probably why, yeah. Let's talk about Stephen Thompson. He called out Jorge Masvidal, and he said that he wanted the belt in the post-fight. The NMF BMF thing does nothing for me, and I don't think it does anything for Jorge Masvidal. I just don't see it. I don't see if you consider yourself a BMF, what the upside to potentially losing to an NMF would be. It makes no sense. And I don't think it'd be marketed all that great. As far as the title goes, here's the good news for him. The people that are above him are Jorge Masvidal, who he's fought, Leon Edwards, who he hasn't, Gilbert Burns, who he hasn't, and Colbert Covington, who hasn't. So all the people above him, you can book him because there's no loss, however long ago, in his past. Do you like his path to the title? Do you think he still has it in him? Or do you think, and I want you to tell me this from the UFC's perspective, when they look at him, does he have more value as a title contender or as a gatekeeper?
It's a really interesting question because he is at the stage of his career where, yes, he's a little bit older and you are starting to see him slow down a little bit. Like, I don't think we're seeing the same Wonder Boy who went out there and wheel kicked Jake Ellenberger or who knocked out Johnny Hendricks in the first round. Like, he's still a very, very good fighter. He is still elite in that weight class, but I don't think we're seeing prime Wonder Boy. So the question is the matchmaking that comes. And I think Wonder Boy is more valuable as a title challenger than, let's say, a Leon Edwards. And it sucks for Leon Edwards because he should be, and he should be the bigger name by now. But the fact, you know, COVID and all that, just this year's been, if anyone's lost 2020, Leon Edwards has lost 2020.
And a bad year for him.
It has been. And I think Wonder Boy, if he could somehow finagle his way to try to fight Leon Edwards next or Colby Covington. See, I think Wonder Boy did the wrong thing calling out Jorge Masvidal because Masvidal's not really in the title picture. He's in the money fight picture. If you want to fight him, you're not doing a lot for your career going towards Kamaru Usman. They're very much two different goals. Do you want to be champ or do you want to try to have money fights and make as much money as possible? For Wonder Boy, he does want that belt. So if I'm him, I call out Colby Covington. Everyone loves Wonderboy Thompson. Everyone hates Colby Covington. It's one of the easiest marketing like schemes the UFC will ever have to put together. Jeez, I could make the commercials for them. It would not be very difficult. I think that's the perfect fight. And I think that's a really good fight too, especially with Covington coming off the Woodley win. Beating Woodley now, I don't really know what that means anymore. Like when Gilbert Burns beat Tyron Woodley, I'm like, oh shit, Gilbert Burns going to win a title. And then Colby Covington beat Tyron Woodley. And I'm like, okay, this is just getting sad. If he does come off that performance against Woodley and can go out there and beat Wonderboy, then we can say, okay, you're next for the winner of Burns and Usman. So I do think that there's a path to get Wonderboy to the title, and I think he can afford a loss and just go back to being the gatekeeper again. So I do think he is kind of, you know, we're moving up in this world, but one more loss and he will be right back in the gatekeeper. So if I'm Wonderboy, I just keep on calling out the bigger fish in the pond.
Yeah, it's weird. I like the Covington fight. My only pushback would be if he does lose. I mean, Covington is the test for Wonderboy to see if you should put him in there with Usman or not. But if he loses, then if Kobe loses, then we lose the Masvidal fight potentially. And I want to see Covington and Masvidal fight, not when they're both weakened state. Real quick for Jeff Neal, Luque lost to Thompson. Now Neal's lost to Thompson. Do you like that matchup? Or do you think bigger fish should be available to Jeff Neal?
So I'm going to say a guy who was in the top 10 of the division and then broke his hand, and we haven't heard about him for a little while. I want Santiago Ponzinibbio to either fight Vicente Luque or Jeff Neal. If you want to have fun, you put that guy in there with one of those two. And those three are very interchangeable to me, if I'm being honest. They're just extremely heavy-handed strikers. They all fight from different stances and whatnot and have their unique little niches, but those guys all pretty much do the exact same thing. I want to see them all fight each other at one point, but I'd love Ponzinibbio to get in there with either Neal or Luque.
All right, sounds good. Let's move on to the co-main event. Matt, when I was in my 30s and you were in your teens, Jose Aldo was one of the best fighters in the entire world. Unmatched speed and power at 145 pounds. Aldo's Hall of Fame jacket has been sewn, and somewhere it hangs awaiting the day when he puts it on. But for now, he's still looking to add to the Hall of Fame resume. On Saturday, it was Chito Vera, who is coming off a surprise win over Sean O'Malley. Vera was looking to take advantage of his move up into the penthouse at 135, and he didn't get it done. The results read Jose Aldo defeating Marlon Vera via unanimous decision, 29-28, all over the board. Matt, what'd you see in this one?
Jose Aldo won every round of that fight. Let's just call it like it is. I thought Aldo looked really good, and I was a little too cocky about my prediction in this fight, and the fact that it went to a decision was kind of surprising. I thought Aldo was going to blow the absolute doors off Marlon Vera, and not just like, oh, beat him every single round. Like, if you go back and look at what John Lineker was able to do to Marlon Vera, and I understand it's a younger Marlon Vera, he rips 1,000 shots to the body and then goes up top. What's Jose Aldo amazing at doing? Ripping 1,000 shots to the body and then going up top. I thought he'd be able to replicate that game plan, and he was able to. I was surprised that we saw as much grappling from Aldo as we did, especially in the third round. We talked about the Marlon Moraes-Rob Font fight, get into that later, about guys who I didn't think would grapple who end up starting the fight grappling, but I thought Aldo looked really good, and I loved the call-out too afterwards, the TJ Dillashaw call-out. Like, that's the perfect fight that I want to see. I want to see Jose Aldo either fight Dominic Cruz or TJ Dillashaw next, and the fact that he called out Dillashaw, Dillashaw's coming off the suspension, I think that's the perfect fight to make at 135. It is sort of one of those money fights, if you will, for the division, just because there's not a lot of guys who can sell tickets at 135. I think everyone can agree it's one of the more exciting divisions. It's one of the more talent-stacked divisions. But there's not a ton of huge names there yet. Jose Aldo's still a guy who, if TJ Dillashaw is able to beat Aldo, it just kind of boosts the already big name that Dillashaw has. And if Aldo can go out there, finish Dillashaw or beat Dillashaw, we could have him right back into the title picture. Now, I don't ever want to see him fight Piotr Jan again, because that fifth round might have scarred me for life. But it is a realistic thing that we could get in the near future. And for Marlon Vera, you lost to arguably the greatest fighter of all time, or in one of those top five Mount Rushmore categories. I don't think it's the end of the world. You go from beating Sean O'Malley to losing a decision against Jose Aldo, where, yeah, you got beat, but you had some good moments in it. So I actually think this is one of those rare win-wins for both guys.
I'm with you on everything you said. Here's my only pushback to Petr Yan and Jose Aldo not fighting again. And I agree with you about the fifth. But here's my thing. Jose Aldo is one thing that we never talk about with Jose Aldo is he is one of those unique fighters, maybe him, maybe George St. Pierre, maybe a couple other guys, where they're so talented that literally you can make a case that they would have won a fight they lost had they just employed a different game plan. Like, you know, sometimes Aldo goes to the body when he should go to the head. Sometimes Aldo doesn't kick enough. Sometimes, like today, you know, Aldo took down Vera and just kind of grinded his way and kind of went rear naked choke hunting for a while, and that was effective. So, I mean, he has so many tools that if he fought Petr Yan with a different game plan, it might be a more interesting fight. So I don't want to discount that fight. I don't know that he's earned it yet, but he's in a unique situation also where he's so much better than everybody else in that weight class, but really not quite championship caliber anymore. And because he was so great when he was in his prime, that even his regression is still better than 90% of the guys he's going to fight. So I like the Dillashaw fight as well. I just think that the UFC is in a weird spot now where they, if they think they have a fight to make, they'll put a guy on ice for a while. Like they wanted to make the Garbrandt fight, right, at 25. And they just, I mean, the COVID stuff's the COVID stuff. But I mean, like, even if he didn't have COVID, if they couldn't make the fight, they'd kind of ice him because, you know, and Craig and I argued about this a while ago, which is, you know, you don't want to have Cody Garbrandt lose to someone that's not a champion because then you lose that name cachet of him losing to the champion. So, yeah, I'm with you that we might want to let Jose Aldo sort of play around in this division, but he still has a name. And you want him to lose to guys that's going to bolster them, you know, in victory. All right, here's my question. I'm with you that Aldo dominated this fight. But in the end, because it was a close fight, do you think Vera might have lost this fight just by making that one key mistake of letting Aldo get his back, even though he was – I'm with you that it was Aldo's fight throughout. But had Vera been a little more competitive in the third, could we have gotten a decision that we all would have argued about? Or, you know what I'm saying? Do you think that was what cost him the fight, or was or had it stayed on the feet?
Again, I thought Aldo won every single round up until then, so I might be in the minority on that one. But I really like the Aldo who throws kicks, and I think we've seen that a lot more at bantamweight than we did the last few fights at featherweight. Because remember the last two Max fights, or I guess both Max fights, and the Volkanovski fight, like, and this, again, such a Joe Roganism, but, oh, Jose Aldo, he's going to throw leg kicks, he's going to throw leg kicks, he's going to throw leg kicks. After the Ricardo Lamas fight, really, he stopped throwing leg kicks, and that could be due to his cardio, that could be because due to leg injuries, whatever, we can speculate forever, really. Jose Aldo's been throwing kicks ever since he's gone back down to 135, and even in the Piotr Jan fight, like, that fifth round was awful to watch, and he did get tired as the fight went on. But he was throwing beautiful kicks that whole time, and he was chopping down that front leg of Jan, and he forced Jan to switch stances. I think he would have been able to go back to that in the third round no matter what, But for Marlon Vera, again, this is when I go back to, it's a win-win situation. If you're Marlon Vera, that can be your mindset afterwards. I never recommend for a fighter to deny that they lost or anything, but if you're Marlon Vera, you can go back to Ruka and Perillo and be like, okay, I made one mistake against the GOAT and I could have arguably had a split decision or whatever against him. So it's a huge confidence booster, again, kind of like the Jeff Neal fight. And I don't think Marlon Vera should hang his head on the performance he put on last night. I really don't. I was equally impressed with how good Vera looked as I was with Aldo. Because again, I thought Aldo was going to knock him out in the first round. I did not think this fight was going to be competitive at all.
You know, the interesting thing about Aldo that is frustrating if you're an Aldo fan is that he, despite his stature, I mean, he's not an overly short guy. He's 5'7", which isn't really short as for a bantamweight. I mean, it's a little bit, it's really not even that short for a featherweight, but he's always sort of fought small. You know what I mean? Like he hasn't, he likes to throw knees. He likes to get in close. He's got short arms, like throw hooks. Really the only thing he does from distance is those kicks. And so for me, I just don't know if he could fight that kind of game against Jan. But again, we've already covered that. So let's talk. If we give him Dillashaw, what do we do with Vera?
So with Vera, I thought about this a lot, actually, and I think I have the perfect matchup. When Nathaniel Wood fought Casey Kenney, it was one of the closer fights of the year, one of the better fights of the year, and more underrated ones, I think. Casey Kenney, he wins the really close decision, and he was rewarded with the Dominic Cruz fight. Marlon Vera lost a close fight to Jose Aldo. I know that this was kind of his chance to put himself over the edge. I would like to see him fight Nathaniel Wood. Nathaniel Wood's nickname is The Prospect. And right now, the UFC wants Marlon Vera to be their prospect at 135 after he beat Sean O'Malley. He's got quite a few fans after that O'Malley win. I'd love to see Nathaniel Wood take on Marlon Vera, kind of prove who is the top of the prospects. And I'm using that term very loosely. Two guys who are a little bit further on in their career than sort of the prospect level, but two guys who are in the beginnings of their prime. And I think we learned a lot from both guys in that fight.
Yeah, the funny thing about MMA is sometimes you go from a prospect straight to a gatekeeper, which makes very little sense, if any. So, all right, let's move on. Matt, this next fight was the kind of fight that gets Davidson Baker's head shaved. A fight that is sure not to go to the judges, that goes to the judges. The Chaos Women's and Michelle Paella have several highlight reel finishes to their name. But on this night, it was indeed the judges that we saw rendering a decision. That decision was 29-28 all over the place. What you have here, and I guess a further question would be, is this just one of those fights where, like, styles make fights and let's just keep these guys the hell away from each other forever? Or what do you think?
Yeah, really. Like, Chaos Williams has to plant to throw with power. It's pretty simple. Michelle Paella never stops moving. It's really hard to hit a guy when your feet are planted. And I'll be very honest, maybe this is a hot take. I didn't really see a lot on Twitter about it. I thought Chaos Williams won the fight. I thought he won 2-1. I wasn't overly upset when they gave Paella the win. I just thought, oh, Chaos Williams did enough in round one and round two. Again, the rear naked choke at the end for Paella, it can win you the third round, but that was really the only big moment I thought he had in that fight. He landed a few nice strikes, but for the most part, I thought Chaos Williams was in control of the fight. But yeah, I agree. This is one of those matchups where never put these guys together. It should look good on paper. And it's one of those, like, this is the 1 out of 100 that was a stinker. The other 99 times that these guys get in the cage together, Michelle Paella lands a turning back kick off of the cage, and Chaos Williams probably lands about 75 overhand rights in the other one. So I do think that we just kind of got the worst case scenario of this fight. But yeah, not to say this is my most disappointing performance or fight on the card, but it was just one of the weirder fights I've seen in a very long time.
Yeah, it's one of those where you, if you see the prop bet that the fight won't go the distance, you jump all over it, and then you get disappointed on that like this. Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of like if you fell asleep and you woke up and this fight was on, you might think you're watching Woodley and Wonder Boy, and then you know your eyes clear up and you rub them and you go, oh, it's Paella. I mean, that's kind of how they decided they wanted to fight. You know, Chaos Williams was very deliberate. Paella was all over the place. I mean, the guy was breakdancing in the friggin' intros. So I mean, that guy's a unique cat, to say the least. But I don't know, like, I could see Williams developing into something. Paella is a little bit of a carnival act to me. I guess my question is, do you think that carnival act has a future? Do you think that he's such an outlier that he could translate that into big things, or do you think that he's just going to be a guy that on some nights will thrill you and on other nights will annoy you, and that's what he is?
Remember that time he got tired in 5 seconds against Tristan Connolly on a week's notice, and Tristan Connolly was a lightweight moving up? Like, yeah. Again, I don't think either one of these guys is the highest ceilings in the world. If I had to say which one might become like a fringe top 15, like gun to my head, I'd probably say Chaos Williams. Because again, when you fight like him, you really only have to get lucky three times in a row against three somewhat recognizable opponents. Like, let's say they put Chaos Williams in there against Alan Jobin, a guy who's, he's a welterweight, but I'd say he's a little bit more famous than just your average welterweight. He's got a bit of a fan base behind him. Let's say Williams goes out there, knocks him out. Then he fights Mike Perry, knocks him out. Like, guys like that who are outside the rankings, but by beating them really gets your name out there. We might be able to see Chaos Williams go on a bit of a run. But again, the issue is that he plants and then throws and plants and then throws. Any guy who moves on the feet should be able to avoid that. And when you look at the two guys who he has beaten under a minute, Alex Morono, who, he's a good fighter. I know Craig and I are a lot higher on him than most people are. But again, he's not the most active guy, and he doesn't have the best footwork in the world. Cracks him. And then Abdul Razak Al-Hassan, who he knocked out in 30 seconds. You don't learn a lot about a guy when his two wins in the UFC are for a combined, well, less than 1 minute. And his one loss is a decision they didn't look that great in. So I don't know where to judge these guys going forward. I just know Michel Pereira could barely beat a Diego Sanchez and ended up losing to him by a legal knee. And he lost to a guy who weighed a lot less than him, who didn't even have a full training camp. So I don't know if you can tell. I'm not overly high on one of these guys.
Yeah, these guys are kind of like, you know, the guys you match up because of what they do on YouTube more than what they actually are. I think the thing that I would tell these guys if they were asking, which they probably aren't asking, but if they were, I would just say, you know, you can't fall in love with your highlights. And I think that sometimes I see these guys going for techniques because they want that big thing that, you know, is the thing that they get known for, the big knockout or the big spinning technique or whatever it is. And it's like, if you want to establish yourself as a championship fighter, those things will come to you if you have the skills, but you can't go chasing them. And I think sometimes these guys are guilty of chasing them. All right, Matt, let's move on. There was a time when only a handful of men dared to stand on the feet with Marlon Moraes, a former World Series of Fighting champion. Moraes was the poor man's Jose Aldo. On this night, he fought Rob Font, who was coming off some big wins and looking to make his ascension into the top 10 using Moraes' back. And he'll probably do just that. The result reads Rob Font defeating Marlon Moraes via TKO. 347 in the very first round. The easy question would be, is this your biggest surprise of the night? But talk about what you got here. What do we have in Font? And how did you react when you saw this happen?
So I want to see if you agree with my comparison right here. I don't think Marlon Moraes is like the knockoff Jose Aldo. He's just a small Alistair Overeem. He's wicked at striking. He has a phenomenal guillotine if anyone shoots on him. But if you even look at his chin the wrong way, he might go down. And I think we are starting to see signs of Marlon Moraes doesn't have, he's not the most durable guy anymore. And not that he ever really was. If you go back and look at his career, like, he's been dropped before. In World Series of Fighting, it's not like he was known for having this phenomenal chin like Justin Gaethje was. It was just, he was out there knocking out a bunch of, and I hate to use the word scrubs, but let's be honest, the level of competition at the time for Marlon wasn't really what it is now. Like, his best win outside the UFC is Marlon, or Shaymon Moraes, a guy who fought three times in the UFC and got cut. So I really liked Marlon Moraes in this fight. I thought he was going to win. I thought he was going to win by stoppage. Rob Font, hittable guy. We've seen him get hurt before. And then Marlon decided, oh, I'm a wrestler now, like Conor McGregor after Nate Diaz tagged him. And it made me so nervous, because when you're coming off a loss like he was against Sandhagen, and when your first reaction is, I'm this wicked striker, let's go out there and start shooting double legs. I know Rob Font isn't the grappler that Marlon Moraes is, but even on the feet, Rob Font is a primary boxer. You have some of the best leg kicks in all of the UFC, not just in your division. I thought the path to victory was pretty easy for Marlon, but the second he started shooting takedowns, I was like, ugh, should not have put as much money on Marlon as I did. And then we all saw what happened. He got cracked in the feet. He kind of hurt Rob Font there for a second, and then, of course, he got finished, but it was a late stoppage, first of all. That's really what stands out to me on this. And I have no idea what you do with either guy after this fight, because with Rob Font, this is his first, I'd say, marquee win in the UFC. He fought John Lineker. He wasn't able to get past him. He fought Pedro Munhoz. He wasn't able to get past him. Marlon Moraes was the first kind of elite guy that he was able to beat. But I still don't really know where I put Rob Font in this division, because the last time he fought Rafael Assuncao, who, again, Assuncao is a good fighter. He's very well-rounded. He does everything quite well. He beat the absolute brakes off poor Rob Font. So I don't really know where I can put Font's ceiling at. And for Marlon, A, don't take a fight 2 months after you just got knocked out by a spinning back kick. Just advice for any young fighters out there watching. Don't know if there are any. And B, do you think that that is the issue for Marlon? Did he take the fight too quick? Or do you just think that he has a durability issue at this point in his career?
It's probably the durability issue. I mean, he probably should have waited longer to take the fight. But I mean, 2 months isn't 2 weeks. I mean, he's had a little bit of recovery time. Yeah, I agree with everything you said. Here's some of my takeaways from this. I think that when Moraes did his homework on Rob Font, he said, well, this guy wants to stand with me and he's you know, nice with the hands, so I'm gonna take him down. The part of the scouting report he didn't read was that Rob Font has no problem getting off his back. You know, Rob Font can get back up when he needs to. Now, for Font, here's what my takeaway to this fight would be. You can look at it one of two ways if you're Rob Font. You can look at it like, man, I'm really fighting good. Or you can look at it like, I fought a mirage of a fighter. I fought someone who people thought, I say this a lot, but whose name is in fact bigger than his game. And I think that if you assess it that way, if you get booked with a rematch with either with Sun Tzu, you'll be more prepared to understand that I need to worry about what happened in a Sun Tzu fight, not what happened in this Moraes fight. Because this, you know, I put hands on him. That's something I do well, and this kid's chinny. And that's how way it worked out. But if you quietly look at some things that Rob Font's doing, listen, this kid is fourth all-time bantamweight finishes. TJ Dillashaw's got 8. He's got 6. So he's right there. I think that when guys start to get championship fights, and we look at them even closer, they start to make their way into co-main events, and we see that some of these stats that back up what they've been doing, obviously a stat like that doesn't tell you who the 6 were or who Dillashaw's 8 were, but you start to build this thing, this narrative where you're like, it starts to make sense that this kid is where he is. And I think for Rob Font, I just want to make sure, and he's at the right camp to do this, but I just want him to make sure that he's reading the right press clippings, that he's looking at this in the right way. If he focuses on his losses and not his wins, I think he'll be ready to really ascend into the top 10 or top 5. But that's the way, that's the approach that he has to take. I mean, you can make that argument that anybody needs to take that approach, but for Rob Font especially, understanding that I am more who I was against a Sun Tzu than I am who I was against Moraes, even though it's a lot funner to watch that Moraes fight back.
Oh, yeah. So the only thing that I have is every time I look at this division, and we were talking earlier about Jose Aldo, how he's so good that if he just tweaks a few things to his game plan, you think he could beat anyone regardless of weight class. Piotr Jan, I think, will become a generational talent. I really do. Like, if I have to point to one guy right now who could become the GOAT, if you will, of their weight class, it's either him or Kamaru Usman. And for Rob Font, I always look ahead of, okay, let's say he goes out there and he fights Corey Sandhagen next, and he beats Corey Sandhagen. You eventually have to fight Piotr Jan, who will just wait there, stand, and not do anything until you throw everything in your arsenal, he downloads your whole game plan, and just marches forward with reckless abandon and puts people away. I have a really hard time looking at Rob Font and the stylistic matchup that he offers to a Piotr Jan, and I think that's why I've sort of discredited him up until this point.
Let's move on to Marcin Tybura and Greg Hardy. Matt, fans have been waiting for so long for Greg Hardy to, quote, get what is coming to him that they've kind of stopped looking for it. Typically, Hardy has outperformed skeptics or had mental lapses that have led to his defeat. However, on this night, Marcin Tybura put it on him, and the referee got involved. The result reads Tybura over Hardy via TKO, 431 of round number 2. I'm going to ask you what you had in this one, but I do have a couple of questions. Mostly those being, here's my main takeaway from this fight, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Greg Hardy is turning himself into a fighter. I'm seeing some technique. I'm seeing that the work with Dean Thomas is paying off. But did he train the savage out of himself? And I would never compare Greg Hardy to Mike Tyson, even though I'm about to. Meaning, was part of what made Greg Hardy a difficult matchup was that you walked in and said, I'm dealing with a loose cannon tonight. So who the hell knows what this guy's capable of or what he's going to do? And now that he's a little bit more cleaner with his stand-up, is he less of a wild card? And thus, fighters can say, I can just fight this guy traditionally. And his lapses in technique will expose themselves. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree wholeheartedly, but I do think that we have started to see chinks in the armor from the second he joined the UFC. Like, the whole Puffergate thing, that was the first thing. But also, in the Alan Crowder fight, like, he was exhausted after about 2 minutes, and I don't think his cardio has improved at all since that fight. I know his striking looked phenomenal in that first round. Like, I was really impressed. I was like, damn, he took everything Alexander Volkov threw at him, and just he's using it now. He's got that nice long right hand. He was using his range quite well. And for Greg Hardy, it's really odd. You can't point to a lot of fighters and say that they use athleticism as a skill. It's something that I've really been harping on a lot in our prediction videos lately, how for instance, Alexander Rakic is a phenomenal fighter. He has all the skills, but what really pushes him over the edge? He's a phenomenal athlete. He's massive. He's extremely physically strong for the weight class. It just sort of puts him over the edge. For Greg Hardy, he's not really using that athleticism anymore. He's relying more on his technique, and it just follows along with what you said. I do think people see a more tamed fighter now. He's not that wild guy who, if he can catch you with that one overhand right, maybe he can knock you out. It's, okay, he throws a right straight. Well, everyone throws a right straight. So as long as I can prepare for his specific techniques, I don't have to worry about the fighter himself. And I think for Marcin Tybura, you could tell that in the fight, he looked a little nervous starting out. Like on the feet, he was a little unsure of himself. He wasn't committing to a lot. And anytime Greg Hardy was throwing, he was getting completely out of the pocket. But as the fight progressed, and you could tell that the steam was coming off of Greg Hardy's punches a little bit, Marcin Tybura, just from a body language standpoint, looked so much more confident, started marching him forward, wasn't as nervous about the power coming back his way. And I think when a guy like Marcin Tybura beats you, I always have Marcin Tybura as my gatekeeper for heavyweight, and I love Marcin Tybura. I might be his only fan. If the UFC sold a fight kit of him, I'd probably have one by now. But if Marcin Tybura is able to beat you, a lot of guys at heavyweight are able to beat you. And I think now people are starting to see that, yes, it's a more tamed heavyweight fighter. And we have started to see that, okay, well, the gas tank's not really there. The grappling's not really there. Like, there's a lot that we could take advantage of if we're fighting Greg Hardy. You just really have to avoid that first 2-3 minute storm. And it's not like it's a 2-3 minute storm like a Rumble Johnson, where he's throwing head kicks, he's throwing uppercuts. Everything he's throwing is really nice if you're Rumble. With Greg Hardy, it's I throw that right straight, I'm pretty fast, but then I fall off a cliff. And I don't really know where we put Greg Hardy after this. Like, I've seen him against Marcin Tybura. I've seen him against Alexander Volkov. Do we just keep on giving him like UFC newcomers for the next year and a half and see how much he progresses at that point?
What I'm about to say, I'm sure they'll be able to poke all kinds of holes in this in the comments, and please do. I love it. So, but here's my thing. I'm going to use other sports to compare because Greg Hardy was a football player, and I have a fairly good example in baseball as well. But, and this is one of my prouder moments as an athlete myself, which is Pete Rose said something that I used to do when I was a kid. And when he said it, I was like, I used to do that. And it was just, maybe he said it. Maybe I saw something he said when I was a kid and kept it. Pete Rose was talking to Alex Rodriguez about hitting a baseball. And he said, when you have issues hitting a baseball, you move up in the box, back in the box, closer to home plate, further away from home plate. He goes, you never change your swing. Your swing's what got you to the big leagues, right? So I'll say that, and now we'll talk about Lamar Jackson, right? So if you change Lamar Jackson to a pocket passer, it takes away everything that's great about Lamar Jackson. Now, I said those two things to say Greg Hardy is where Greg Hardy is because of who Greg Hardy is, right? Now, you can take that for however you want to take it, but I think that, yes, you want to develop technique, but if in doing so you remove the thing that got everybody on their heels, when it, like you said, when Tybura realized that the heat coming wasn't the heat, normal heat, you know, it's like if you're a pitcher. Every once in a while, you know, if you're Roger Clemens, you got to throw at a guy's head just to remind them that you'll throw it at their head. And it makes everything else more effective. He's starting to lose the fact that he's a loose cannon. And I think people are saying, well, we can deal with this. This isn't that bad. So I guess my question is, to follow up all that, is I looked at this guy on the ground, Matt, and I saw nothing. Like, he got taken down. I didn't see him moving his hips. I didn't see him bridging. I didn't see him doing anything that I would have liked to see a guy who's trying to get off the ground. So I don't want to say, is he capable on the ground, or question his training. Is the hill that he has to climb on the ground just too steep at this level? I mean, there's not most heavyweights prefer to stand and bang, but even the guys that prefer to stand and bang, if they know they can take you down and that's it, that's what they're going to do. So, I mean, does he have too much ground to pick up, make up on the ground?
I got to be honest, when he first started fighting MMA, I thought it was a complete sideshow. I thought it would be a lot more similar to a CM Punk experiment than to what it really is. And Greg Hardy has developed into a somewhat decent fighter. Like, I can't take anything away from him. We've seen improvements from performance to performance, and we have seen those holes. But for Greg Hardy, like you had said, he offered nothing on the ground. Like, people make fun of Derek Lewis for his grappling, but if Derek Lewis fought Greg Hardy, I'm damn sure the first thing he's going to do is shoot a double leg, get him down to the ground, and just ground and pound him immediately. And even Derek Lewis, when he gets taken down, he can shrimp, he can get his guard back, and he can get back up to his feet. Hashtag just get up is a real thing. And maybe Greg Hardy at some point can figure out a way to use his athleticism to somewhat bridge the gap or to make up the deficit that he has in grappling. but you have to learn basically completely from the beginning how to defend takedowns and get back up to your feet. And you're not like a Rob Font who, yes, the grappling might not be the best part of his game, but he just knows how to get up. Or Michael Bisping is a good example. He didn't go for a lot of submissions when he was on his back. He was a great striker, so people would try to take him down. But he was just so good at getting my back to the cage, wall walking my way up the cage, and working my way back up to my feet. There are ways to get around just becoming a good grappler. But like you had said, Greg Hardy offered nothing. Like, it was like when Francis fought Stipe at UFC 220, and Stipe at one point was on his knees in side control, just throwing punches down at Francis, and Francis had nothing controlling him there. He was just laying on his back like he's LeBron after a layup, waiting for his teammate to come pick him up. Like, I think that Greg Hardy can do it. If he really focuses on it, he could, because he has improved so much in his game already. But again, I think this is one of those, it's going to take two and a half, three years for him to be even be able to be a little bit competitive with a guy like Tabora on the ground. So I think it might be too much ground to really make up, but I'm sure he will be able to show, you know, minor improvements in his grappling. But again, cardio, if you're tired, you can't defend takedowns. So he either has to buy a treadmill and do nothing but like put on wrestling shoes and defend takedowns for the next 2 years, or I just really don't know what he's going to do.
I almost would prefer that that was what he did, and then they left his striking alone. I mean, even though his striking isn't perfect, at least before he was enough of a force of nature with his striking that he kind of got your got your pulse moving a little bit when he came after you. I will just say this as a complete side note: any one of the fans listening now that can turn Matt Allen wall walking into a GIF, I will sign this hat and send it to you. Because I would love that as an out-of-context GIF where no one knows that you're wall-walking. They just think that you're, you know, dancing. So, that aside, let's move on to the prelims. I got only an intro for the Pettis fight because I think he deserves it, Matt. If Anthony Pettis was an internet meme, speaking of internet memes, it would say how it started, the Showtime kick, how it's going, the prelims. He drew Alex Morono on this night, and the result read 29-28 all over the board for Pettis. Has this guy got anything left? I mean, what are we dealing with here?
I got to be honest, I'm more impressed with Anthony Pettis than I ever thought I would be. And I'm not an Anthony Pettis guy. I've never been a big Anthony Pettis fan. And I've kind of seen his whole arc from when I started getting into MMA. Because Craig and I got into MMA when John Jones had beat when Shogun beat Lyoto Machida in their rematch for the title. Like, that's when we first really started getting into it. And that was around the time where you've got the WEC merger, you've got the Strikeforce merger, there's all these new fighters in the UFC. And Anthony Pettis is at the top of the list for, like, this the guy you have to be excited about. Of course, everyone knows the Showtime kick. He said in his interview with Ariel Helwani this week about how, like, in all of his interviews before that, after the RDA fight, he was never talking about, oh, I need to get better or I need to improve this. It was always, I just need one more win, I'm back to the title. I just need one more win, I'm back to the title. And he was less focused on improving himself and more focused on, okay, I just got to like knock out the next guy. How do I get back to the title? How do I get back to the title? Anthony Pettis, as of late, I know the Cowboy fight was somewhat controversial, but he beat Cowboy at the start of the year. He beats Alex Morono now. And I know he keeps on talking about moving down to 155. And I hate it when people do this, but I'm about to do this. Just go to Bellator and try to become the welterweight champ. Like, your brother's over there. Benson Henderson's over there. You can have that fight again. Like, there's so many money fights, if you will, over in Bellator for Anthony Pettis right now that I think that would be the smartest move for his career. I still think that he has the competitive edge over most guys over there, and he could fight at 155, he could fight at 170, and there's a ton of fun fights that we've yet to see from him. I'm really excited about Anthony Pettis moving forward. I know I'm in the minority, but actually, I'm really proud of what I've seen as of late.
Not for nothing, that should be a keeping score, so you should do that. Anthony Pettis to Bellator would be a great keeping score to really like flesh it out. I agree, 100%. I think that he is a guy. You know, one thing that doesn't get talked about a lot, and some people think it's cliche and some people think it's corny, is when fighters go on these, like, they make commitments to a certain part of their games, and it's like, oh, he's doing this or always doing that. You know, like where you see like a fighter who, like, you see him in a bunch of jiu-jitsu tournaments, and he's posting stuff on Instagram where he fought in this one or that one. In my day, it used to be the Abu Dhabi Combat, ADCC. A guy would always commit to ADCC and then changes. You know, the guy takes a trip to Thailand. Really gets into Muay Thai.
Gets Bangkok ready.
I want to see these things. I mean, I think that's an important part of your career. Take a year off and go to Thailand and just see what's cracking over there. And you know, I like him going to Bellator more than any of those things, but those things would be interesting as well. It's time for you to have like a like some sort of a journey or a pilgrimage to a different part of it. It's a missionary work, you know, do something like it's a silly cliche to use missionary work legitimately, but like an MMA missionary work where you just say, I'm dedicating this part of my life to this thing.
But right, I mean, just the year off for the break, like the mental break. Again, Jorge Masvidal, after he, well, before he beat Darren Till, like we hadn't seen him after the Wonderboy fight. He goes for that year away on the island, doesn't have a lot of social media or whatnot, gets a little bit detached from kind of the fight game, and it completely changed his career for the better. So maybe just the time off to, you know, recuperate mentally could even do wonders for him.
Yeah, and maybe like you said, maybe he does a little bit of both. He takes some time off, commits himself to helping his brother's career, and then helping his brother's career and meeting with the Bellator people and all that. He ends up going there. And listen, one thing also never gets talked about. If you want to go to Bellator, you want to do it after a win. Go do it on your terms. So it seems like you're choosing, maybe you're cashing a big check or you're going over there. Don't go there after you had three losses in a row when it seems like, you know, you're on your last legs. All right, Craig. Or Craig. I did it again. All right, man.
Goodness.
We've moved. It'll fade. Trust me. I'm getting better. This is the portion where I start butchering names, so be prepared. Panny Kinzad defeated Sajara Eubanks via unanimous decision. 29-28, it's all over the board. What do you got here?
It was a pretty good fight, honestly. I thought Eubanks is going to be able to win it. Again, she's one of those fighters who she does use her physicality quite a bit as a skill. And Kianzad, I just wasn't overly sold on, but it was a fairly entertaining fight. I unfortunately think that this is Sajara Eubanks. This is her putting in her application for the Dana White 60 or 80 or whoever we want to call them. She's now 6-6. We all know her trouble with the promotion, really her whole UFC career. It's unfortunate to say that, but that's probably the last time we've seen her in the UFC. For Kianzad, when you look at her record, she's fought really good fighters, especially as of late. And I say really good fighters, and then Betch Kohe is one of the first names that pops up. But still, she's been on a decent little run. She has the win over Betch Kohe. She beat Jessica Rose Clark. Kianzad getting the win over Eubanks. I think Eubanks is better than most people, really. I think she's got a decent skill set. And I think beating someone like her, she's kind of good at everything. It's a good introduction to, okay, now you're ready to start fighting some of the elite fighters in the weight class. So I thought Kianzad looked pretty good, but nothing too crazy about that fight stands out. But Deron Wynn looked really good against Antonio Ahoyo. It was one of those really weird fights where it comes down to what do you emphasize more? Do you judge the wrestling or do you judge the striking? Because in the first round, Ahoyo would beat the absolute brakes off Porter on Wynn on the feet, but then Wynn could take him down 7 times and not do anything with them. And then as the fight progressed, you could just tell when you're Antonio Ahoyo, he must cut down from like 250 pounds to make 195 because he looked to be about 9 weight classes bigger than Porter on Wynn. But as the fight progressed, being big is great, but you also get tired a lot faster. And he was absolutely exhausted by that third round. And really, Deron Wynn just put on a wrestling clinic. We don't learn a lot from either guy because we already knew Antonio Ahoyo doesn't have very good wrestling defense. And we all knew that Deron Wynn's a good wrestler with no stand-up. So again, it was just one of those fights that their styles made for somewhat of a compelling matchup. But I thought the right guy won and win.
All right, through the magic of editing, we'll fix this. So I'll do the intro that I just did, and then we'll change it. Honey, I Shrunk DC. Deron Wynn defeated Antonio Arroyo via unanimous decision. 29-28 all over the board. Let's move on. Taya Santos defeated Jillian Robertson via unanimous decision. 30-26, 30-26, 29-28. Listen, I'm seeing all this propaganda of Jillian Robertson training with Dean Thomas and how it's going to change. She's going to be the next big thing. And then we have this. What do you make of this?
I'm glad you used the term propaganda because I definitely fell for it. I was like, oh, Jillian Robertson, she's already a great grappler. Now she's full-time with Dean Thomas, more one-on-one training, less of a group environment like he would have had at ATT. You know what? She's a black belt. She has good wrestling. She'll beat Taya Santos. Not at all. Taya Santos was like, yeah, Matt Allen, FNP, I'm going to ruin your whole parlay and your predictions because she looked absolutely phenomenal. She really did. And I can't say enough things about Taya Santos. You look at her record and it's a little bit salty. She hasn't fought the highest level of competition throughout her career, but you just look at the improvements that she has been able to make from fight to fight. And she's not known for her ground game, but the fact that she was willing to go out there, she had really nice hip tosses and she was getting Robertson to the mat where I thought, okay, if she's going out there looking for takedowns over Robertson, she might be able to win minutes of the fight, but eventually Robertson's going to find an arm, find a leg, scramble out of it, work her way on top. That never happened. Jillian Robertson just kept on jumping for arm bars like she was our boy Jimmy Flick from the prelims, and it just didn't really work. And once you go to that well, Michael Bisping had said it, I forget which fight it was. Oh, when Dustin Poirier fought Dan Hooker, Michael Bisping was on commentary. And Poirier would go, he'd jump guillotine and then go like omoplata. And you could tell that on the ground, Poirier was quite a bit better than Dan Hooker. That's why he was comfortable with jumping for submissions. But after you do that once or twice and you don't get it, stop doing it. If you're Julian Robertson and you pull guard on an armbar three times, how about we stop doing it? Why not go for it for the fourth? How about we shoot a double leg? It was just kind of weird game planning, and it was one of the stranger fights. But again, I was really impressed by the performance that Santos put on, and I'm more than ready to see her against some of the elite in that division.
Okay, here's the one I'm going to butcher. Tefan Nchukwi defeated Jamie Pickett via unanimous decision. 30-25, 230-26 is how I do.
Tefan Nchukwi. You just there get rid go. Of the... Yeah, and again, I butchered it a lot of times in our video, and Craig got very mad at me multiple times, but that's for another time or the blooper reel. He looked great against Jamie Pickett. Jamie Pickett, they were really hyping him up. He was on Contender Series three times, which is never a great sign, but he was coming off a win, and he throws these big, crazy flurries if he does get someone hurt. But with Tefan Nchukwi, it would have been the Joe Rogan narrative of, oh, Tefan, he's a big guy. He's really muscular. He's going to get tired. 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 He never got tired. He got better as the fight progressed, and he looked really good. I loved his striking. It was weird where Jamie Pickett at a certain point of the fight would get hit, and he wouldn't turn his head like Alistair over him and run away, but you could just tell that the power was getting to him. He wasn't going down because of it, but every time he got cracked, he felt the force of that shot. And I'm a lot more impressed by Tefan Nchukwi. The fact that he did go all 15 minutes and we didn't just see a flash knockout, because I don't learn anything about you if you're a knockout artist and you just keep on knocking people out. I just know that you have that one really good component in your game. Now that I see that you have that crazy power, but you can also stay disciplined when you have a guy hurt and you can stretch a fight out 15 minutes and keep your power late. Really impressed by Nchukwi, and I do think he can go far at 185.
Take it easy on Joe. Those big muscles need oxygen, Matt.
All right, Tyron Woodley.
All right, Jimmy Flick defeated Cody Durden by submission via triangle choke. 318 of round number one. What'd you have here?
Oh my God. That was one of the nicest submissions I've ever seen. Like, if you hit a flying anything by pulling guard, I'm going to be a big fan of yours for life. And this was an interesting fight because, again, Cody Durden is a good grappler, but he has the wrestling side of the grappling game, whereas Flick much more credentialed in jiu-jitsu. The stand-up wasn't phenomenal by either guy, but the second he lashed at that submission, I'm pretty sure he got $50,000. It's a crime if he did not from Dana White. I'm almost 100% sure he did. But it was, if that's not submission of the year, it's officially on the short list at the end of the year for sub of the year, because that was just so nice to watch.
All right, moving on. Christos Giagos defeated Carlton Minus via unanimous decision. 30-26, 29-27, 29-28. What you got here?
So this is one of those weird fights where Rick Glenn falls out. Christos Giagos takes his place. And I'm like, well, this is really weird because Rick Glenn's a decent fighter. He's a good 145er. We haven't seen him in a little bit. Injuries and whatnot. Christos Giagos is a decent lightweight, though. Like, he's been in there with some really good fighters. He's good to have his name in the history book forever because he is who Charles Oliveira beat to get his submission record by beating Royce Gracie. Christos Giagos, unfortunately, was on the receiving end of that rear naked choke. And with Giagos, everyone's really up in arms. They're like, oh, his grappling. It's not great because he's been submitted. He got submitted by Gilbert Burns and Charles Oliveira. That's going to happen. I don't care how good a grappling you are. Like, if you're in there with those guys, there's a good chance you can get finished by submission. We saw what we knew we were going to get. You have a guy in Carlton Minus coming in off Contender Series. I kind of liken him to one of those fighters who they're in the UFC a little bit too soon. I know he is 10-3, which is, you know, it's not nothing, but he's a very raw talent and he is quite green. And to throw him in there with a guy like Giagos, who has really good volume, has good grappling, can mix it up on the feet, but he has awful cardio in Giagos that I figured Giagos is going to be able to win. That third round was a little iffy again, just because of the gas tank of Christos Giagos, but I thought it was a good fight to get the night started. But again, it's one of those fights you don't learn a lot from either guy, because Giagos going into that fight, he was a big favorite. He deserved to be the big favorite because his last loss was a close one against Dracar Close. And Carlton Minus in his second UFC fight hasn't looked good in either one of them. I'll be curious to see if they give him a third try, but really hard loss for Carlton Minus. And for Christos Giagos, listen, he was out for a year. If you're in his position, a fight like this isn't bad to get the ring rust off.
All right, man, let's get out of here in a rush with the wrap. Let's start with some housekeeping notes. Performance of the night, you alluded to $50,000 to Stephen Thompson, $50,000 to Rob Font, $50,000 to Marcin Tybura, and $50,000 to your boy Jimmy Flick. Do you agree with all those? I mean, they seem pretty straightforward, pretty obvious.
I'm a big fan when the UFC gives out performance bonuses to guys who don't win by finish. I think they should do that more often. I think we get a lot of fight of the nights because you have one guy who's better than the other guy, but the other guy's too tough for his own good. I always look back to when Ferguson fought Justin Gaethje. It's on like fight of the years and whatnot. Was that really that good of a fight in hindsight? No, it was one guy throwing overhand rights and left hooks, and the other guy was just really, really tough. It's a great fight, but again, it's one of those, I think Gaethje probably deserved a performance bonus, then that was your fight of the night. I agree a lot with this main event. The first time I ever really remember seeing it and it really stood out was when RDA beat Anthony Pettis for the title. They gave him the performance bonus last night, and I was like, well, that makes sense. It was a good fight, but even though he didn't get the finish, it was one-sided. I agree with all those bonuses.
Let's move on to the victory lap. Let's talk about where Matt was right. Take some time, tip your cap, pick up your roses. Where were you right on this night?
I had a pretty good night. I had I went 8-4. And again, it was a weird card because the fights that I got wrong, I got very wrong. But the fights that I was far too confident about and had no business being, I was actually justified in that. The Duran Nguyen, Antonio Ahoyo fight, I know after the weigh-ins, a lot of people got cold feet on Duran Nguyen, just because the size discrepancy between the two was so massive. And most people think Antonio Ahoyo, the stat always gets bring up, oh, well, people bring him in when they're fighting Thiago Santos. He's really good at emulating him. He's not Thiago Santos, and he doesn't really fight that much like him in the actual cage. I was overly confident about that pick, but it ended up paying off. Markson Tabora was an underdog over Greg Hardy. And again, I just thought, we've got a guy with a ton of experience. He's been a UFC, or he's been a champion outside the UFC, sorry, against Greg Hardy, who, with prospects, there's always different little humps they have to get over. With Greg Hardy and his fight against Jorgen De Castro, it was the leg kick and calf kick hump. And he had never faced anyone who fought like that before. And Jorgen De Castro beat his leg up really, really bad. And then, of course, De Castro broke his foot and he wasn't good after that. We've never seen Greg Hardy on the ground. And that's why I was so confident with Marcin Tybura. So really happy that that one paid off. And yeah, with the main event, I was Jeff Neal all week. I switched to Wonderboy at the last minute. Really happy I did that. And I'm done doubting Wonderboy. Like, I know we talked about, is he a gatekeeper? Could he get back to the title? He's an interesting matchup for Usman, the more I think about it. Like, Usman probably beats the brakes off and blows the doors off him. He's way younger, he's bigger, and he's just a bad matchup for Wonderboy. But Wonderboy at this stage in his career is just crafty and tricky. And I can't really point to who he beats in the top 15, but I can't really point to who can beat him in the top 15 either.
Yeah, he's definitely an enigma up there. Let's talk about the things that you might have missed. We talked earlier about Jillian Robertson. What else were things where you're like, I just didn't see this coming?
I didn't think Rob Font had bricks in his hands, and I wasn't yet aware of the fact that Marlon Moraes has a glass chin. Now, that's a harsh term to use. I hope Marlon does not rewatch our little post-fight show, but that was surprising. And I do think the Overeem comparison is almost perfect. Like, most of their submissions come by guillotines. Most of their wins come by knockout. They both throw a bunch of kicks and knees, and they both can't take punches on the chin. I expect his career to not play out as successfully, though, as Overeem's, now that we know what we know about Marlon. Because if Overeem, okay, you don't have a great chin, but you kind of use that to your benefit. Like, Overeem sticks his head out there a little bit to get guys to throw just so he can counter them. I don't see Marlon ever really developing that side of his game, but that was probably my most disappointing performance and a pick that I was fairly confident about going into Saturday.
All right, let's talk about some takeaways. For me, my big takeaway is that maybe, just maybe, Stephen Thompson, Jose Aldo, and Rob Font might be a little closer to a belt than I thought they were. I don't know that I would by any means put them even as a close underdog to the guys that currently hold those belts. But I thought Rob Font wasn't quite there yet, and he may not be. It might have been just a great matchup. And I think I thought that I'd already written the obituaries of Thompson and Aldo. I think that I might have been wrong about those two guys. What's your takeaway from tonight? What sticks with you?
Again, I'm going to go back to the Anthony Pettis. Anthony Pettis is your new Bellator lightweight champion now that Michael Chandler's gone. Congrats, guys. I'm calling it right now. And we can go back to this video a year and a half from now once Anthony Pettis is lifting that belt over his head. I think it's it for him in the UFC. I just think it makes too much sense. And I agree 100% with what you said. When you see a UFC fighter go to Bellator off four losses, you're like, well, of course, that's where they're going. But with Anthony Pettis, he is in that Benson Henderson kind of Ryan Bader category where it's like, okay, I'm still pretty good, and I would argue Pettis has a bigger name than either one of those two guys who went over to Bellator. So if he can go over, I don't want to see him fight Douglas Lima. I think that was the biggest mistake Benson Henderson made. He was like, yeah, I'll fight for the title at 170, and Koreshkov destroyed him. I don't want to see that, but I would see Anthony Pettis fight, let him fight Benson in his first fight back or over in Bellator. I know Benson only has a year and a half left he put on his career. I was talking to him a couple weeks ago, and for Pettis, yeah, go over there. There's a bunch of fun matchups. You can fight at two separate weight classes, and you might even be able to become champ. And Bellator would then be able to say, we have the Pettis brothers as our kind of our two big stars, and it might help to strengthen their brand a little bit and for both Bellator and the Pettis brothers. So I think Pettis leaving on a win and looking really good is the biggest storyline for me.
All right, let's talk about who won tonight. Who do you think won tonight?
Who won the night? Well, I can tell you who won the night, I think, the most. Rob Font won the night because I know I was really skeptical going into this about this might just be a little bit too much. And we've seen Rob Font in these positions before. And when you do have a guy who has had a few chances and he has had a few cracks at the top, but he just can't make it over the hump, can't make it over the hump. When he finally does make it over the hump, it always feels like it's something special because now we can see him in there with those other elite fighters at bantamweight, with the guys who he hasn't been able to get a fight with. Like, if we get Rob Font versus Cody Garbrandt next at 135, I would be so excited. Like, there's a ton of fights at 135 for Rob Font that he hasn't been in there with. He could make that run up to the title now, and beating a guy like Marlon does prove that to me. So I still think Rob Font, for me, he's gained the most in at least my mind.
I think I the way I kind of figured this out is, you know, all these shows like Errol Hawani and all these other shows, who's the guy I would most want to hear from on Monday? And that's the guy that probably won the night. And for me, it's Rob Font. Like you said, Wonder Boy's had bigger nights. Jose Aldo's had bigger nights. I don't know if Rob Font's had bigger nights. It's probably the biggest night of his career. All right, let's hit the notebook up really, really quickly. Fitzgerald, Cormier, Bisping. What do you think? You like
Loved
them?
It. Yeah, how about we just get rid of Joe Rogan and replace him with Michael Bisping? Like, we can do it in stand-up. We can do it in the podcast. Like, anything, really. DC and Michael Bisping have that fun dynamic where I know people like that between DC and Joe Rogan is kind of silly. Bisping offers a lot of that, but also when it comes down to actual fight technique and talking about the fights themselves, he must actually like watch fight nights because he knows about most of the fighters on there, unlike Joe Rogan. And he just seems to be the more well-read and researched guy at this point. I really like Fitzgerald too. I like him and DC have this weird dynamic where it's like DC's like the big brother always giving him a hard time. I really like those three. Like, if we could have those three and then just switch out Fitzgerald for John Anik every other week, I'd be more than happy.
Yeah, I think that Fitzgerald and Bisping put together a relationship doing some Contender Series stuff. Mm. So they've worked together. DC can work with anybody. I mean, DC could, you know, my son and my daughter could do the UFC pay-per-view with DC, and it'd be a hell of a night on commentary. So, yeah, I liked it a lot. I think it's they're going well. I really just want to take my hat off to Michael Bisping really turning himself into a good commentator. He wasn't great at the very beginning, but he's turning himself into that. All right, so what do we got? 3 weeks until the next one? What are you guys looking at coming up? What's next on Fight Night Picks in your world?
A lot of stuff coming out. I know Craig and I are going to be trying new shows. We've got all those little shorts for Manscaped that's coming out. Like, it's still going to be a busy few weeks for us. We got a few new shows kind of that we're developing, if you will, right now. But yeah, just because the fight stopped doesn't mean Fight Night Picks have stopped. We're just rolling into 2021. Going to make sure 2021 was a hell of a lot better year than 2020.
There you go. Hit the comments and tell Matt to get onto the document for the end of year awards. Let me know what to do. We're going to do some end of year award stuff coming up. I'll be putting that up for you guys. We'll either do an early stoppage or we'll do it just on its own. And either way, we'll be getting Matt's input, obviously. All right, guys. Last fight of the year. We're rocking and rolling on the recap show. We're looking for a big year in 2021. Talk to you later. Next time, 3 weeks from now. Peace.